Well, the system is that I shall talk about a matter which for the moment interests me, and cast it aside and talk about something else the moment its interest for me is exhausted. It is a system which follows no charted course, and is not going to follow any such course. It is a system which is a complete and purpose jumble, a course which begins nowhere, follows no specified route, and can never reach end while I am alive, for the reason that if I should talk to this stenographer 2 hours a day for 100 years, I should still never be able to set down a tenth part of the things which have interested me in my lifetime. I told Howells that this autobiography of mine would live a couple thousand years without any effort, and would then take a fresh start and live the rest of the time. He said he believed it would, and asked me if I meant to make a library of it. I said that that was my design, but that if I should live long enough, the set of volumes could not be contained merely in a city. It would require a state, and that there would not be any multi-billionaire alive, perhaps, at any time during its existence, who would be able to buy a full set, except on the installment plan. Howells applauded and was full of praises and endorsement, which was wise in him and judicious. If he had manifested a different spirit, I would have thrown him out the window. I like criticism, but it must be my way. Number 1. Back of the Virginia Clemenses is a dim procession of ancestors stretching back to Noah's time. According to tradition, some of them were pirates and slavers in Elizabeth's time, but this is no discredit to them, for so were Drake and Hawkins and the others. It was a respectable trade then, and monarchs were partners in it. In my time, I have had desires to be a pirate myself. The reader, if he will look deep down in his secret heart, will find, but never mind what he will find there. I am not writing his autobiography, but mine. Later, according to tradition, one of the processions was ambassador to Spain in the time of James I, or of Charles I, and married there and sent down a strain of Spanish blood to warm us up. Also, according to tradition, this one or another, Geoffrey Clement by name, helped to sentence Charles to death. I have not examined into these traditions myself, partly because I was indolent, and partly because I was so busy polishing up this end of the line and trying to make it showy. But the other Clemenses claim that they have made the examination and that it stood the test. Therefore, I have always taken for granted that I did help Charles out of his troubles by ancestral proxy. My instincts have persuaded me to. Whenever we have a strong and persistent and ineradicable instinct, we may be sure that it is not original with us, but inherited from way back. and I have always felt friendly towards Satan. Of course, that is ancestral. It must be in the blood, for I could not originate it. And so, by the testimony of instinct, backed by the assertions of Clemens's, who said they had examined the records, I have always been obliged to believe that Jeffrey Clement, the martyr maker, who was an ancestor of mine, and to regard him with favor and, in fact, pride. This has not had a good effect upon me, for it has made me vain, and that is a fault. It has made me set myself above people who were less fortunate in their ancestry than I, and has moved me to take them down a peg upon occasion and say things to them which hurt them before company. A case of the kind happened in Berlin several years ago. William Walter Phelps was our minister at the Emperor's court then, and one evening he had me to dinner to meet Count S., a cabinet minister. This noble man was of long and illustrious descent. Of course, I wanted to let out the fact that I had some ancestors too, but I did not want to pull them out of their graves by the ears, and I never could seem to get the chance to work them in a way that would look sufficiently casual. I suppose Phelps was in the same difficulty. In fact, he looked distraught now and then, just as a person looks who wants to uncover an ancestor purely by accident and cannot think of a way that will seem accidental enough. But at last, after dinner, he made a try. He took us about his drawing room, showing us the pictures, and finally stopped before a rude and ancient engraving. It was a picture of the court that tried Charles I. There was a pyramid of judges in Puritan slouch hats, and below them, three bareheaded secretaries seated at a table. Mr. Phelps put his finger upon one of the three and said with exulting indifference, "An ancestor of mine." I put my finger on the judge and retorted with scathing languidness, "Ancestor of mine? But it is a small matter. I have others." It was not noble in me to do it. I have always regretted it since. But it landed him. I wonder how he felt. However, it made no difference in our friendship, which shows that he was fine and high, notwithstanding the humbleness of his origin. And it was also credible in me, too, that I could overlook it. I made no change in my bearing toward him, but always treated him as an equal. But it was a hard night for me in one way. Mr. Phelps thought I was the guest of honor, and so did Count S. But I didn't, for there was nothing in my invitation to indicate it. It was just a friendly offhand note on the card. By the time dinner was announced, Phelps was himself in a state of doubt. Something had to be done, and it was not a handy time for explanations. He tried to get me to go out with him, but I finally went out in the pile. There was a decorous plunge for seats, and I got the one that Mr. Phelps left. Count got to the one facing Phelps, and the other guest had to take the place of honor, since he could not help himself. We returned to the drawing room in the original disorder. I had new shoes on, and they were tight. At 11, I was privately crying. I couldn't help it, the pain was so cruel. Conversation had been dead for an hour. S had been due at the bedside of a dying official ever since 9:30. At last, we all rose by one blessed impulse and went down to the street door without explanations, in a pile, and no precedence, and so parted. The evening had its defects. Still, I got my ancestor in and was satisfied. Among the Virginian Clemenses were Jerry, already mentioned, and Sherrard. Jerry Clemens had a wide reputation as a good pistol shot, and once it enabled him to get on the friendly side of some drummers when they wouldn't have paid any attention to mere smooth words and arguments. He was out stumping the state at the time. The drummers were grouped in front of the stand and had been hired by the opposition to drum while he made his speech. When he was ready to begin, he got out his revolver and laid it before him and said in his soft, silky way, "I do not wish to hurt anybody, and shall try not to, but I have got just a bullet apiece for those 6 drums, and if you should want to play on them, don't stand behind them." Sherrard Clemens was a Republican congressman from West Virginia in the war days, and then went out to St. Louis, where the James Clemens branch lived, and still lives, and there he became a warm rebel. This was after the war. At the time that he was a Republican, I was a rebel. But by the time he became a rebel, I was become temporarily a Republican. The Clemenses have always done the best they could to keep the political balances level, no matter how much it might inconvenience them. I did not know what had become of Sherrard Clemens, but once I introduced Senator Hawley to a Republican mass meeting in New England, and then I got a bitter letter from Sherrard from St. Louis. He said that the Republicans of the North, no, the Dyeings of the North, had swept away the old aristocracy of the South with fire and sword, and it ill became me, an aristocrat by blood, to train with that kind of swine. Did I forget that I was a Lambton? That was a reference to my mother's side of the house. As I have already said, she was a Lambton. Lambton with a P, for some of the American Lamptons could not spell very well in early times, and so the name suffered at their hands. She was a native of Kentucky and married my father in Lexington in 1823 when she was 20 years old and he 24. Neither as a fiction, an invention, extravagant impossibility, and did me the honor to call him a creation. But they were mistaken. I merely put him on paper as he was. He was not a person who could be exaggerated. The incidents which looked most extravagant, both in the book and on the stage, were not inventions of mine, but were facts of his life, and I was present when they were developed. John G. Raymond's audiences used to come near to dying with laughter over the turnip-eating scene, but extravagant as the scene was, it was faithful to the facts in all its absurd details. The thing happened in Lampton's own house, and I was present. In fact, I was myself the guest who ate the turnips. In the hands of a great actor, that pithy scene would have dimmed any manly spectator's eyes with tears and racked his ribs apart with laughter at the same time. But Raymond was great in humorous portrayal only, in that he was superb. He was wonderful, in a word, great. In all things else, he was a pygmy of the pygmies. The real Colonel Sellers, as I knew him in James Lampton, was a pathetic and beautiful spirit, a manly man, a straight and honorable man, a man with a big, foolish, unselfish heart in his bosom, a man born to be loved. And he was loved by all his friends and by his family, worshipped. It is the right word. To them, he was but little less than a god. The real Colonel Sellers was never on the stage. Only half of him was there. Raymond could not play the other half of him. It was above his level. That half was made up of qualities of which Raymond was wholly destitute. For Raymond was not a manly man. He was not an honorable man, nor an honest one. He was empty and selfish and vulgar and ignorant and silly, and there was a vacancy in him where his heart should have been. There was only one man who could have played the whole of Colonel Sellers, and that was Frank Mayo. Footnote: Raymond was playing Colonel Sellers in 1876, and along there, about 20 years later, Mayo dramatized Pudd'nhead Wilson and played the title role delightfully. It is a world of surprises. They fall, too, where one is least expecting them. When I introduced Sellers into the book, Charles Dudley Warner, who was writing the story with me, proposed a change of Sellers' Christian name. 10 years before, in a remote corner of the West, he had come across a man named Eschol Sellers, and he thought that Eschol was just the right fitting name for our Sellers, since it was odd and quaint and all that. I liked the idea, but I said that that man might turn up and object. But Warner said it couldn't happen. This damaged aristocrat's program was quite definite and businesslike. The American Publishing Company must suppress the edition as far as printed and change the name in the plates or stand a suit for $10,000. He carried away the company's promise and many apologies, and he changed the name back to Colonel Mulberry Sellers in the plates. Apparently, there is nothing that cannot happen. Even the existence of two unrelated men wearing the impossible name of Eschel Sellers is a possible thing. James Lampson floated all his days in a tinted mist of magnificent dreams and died at last without seeing one of them realized. I saw him last in 1884 when it had been 26 years since I ate the basin of raw turnips and washed them down with a bucket of water in his house. He was become old and white-headed, but he entered to me in the same old breezy way of his earlier life, and he was all there yet, not a detail wanting. The happy light in his eye, the abounding hope in his heart, the persuasive tongue, the miracle-breeding imagination, they were all there, and before I could turn around, he was polishing up his Aladdin's lamp and flashing the secret riches of the world before me. I said to myself, I did not overdraw him by a shade. I set him down as he was, and he is the same man today. Cable Liberty Prison. I asked him to excuse me a moment and ran into the next room, which was Cable's. Cable and I were stumping the union on the reading tour. I said, I am going to leave your door open so that you can listen. There is a man in there who is interesting. I went back and asked Lampton what he was doing now, and he began to tell me of a small venture he had begun in New Mexico through his son. Only a little thing, a mere trifle, partly to amuse my leisure, partly to keep my capital from lying.